Good afternoon, everybody. We are limited on time this afternoon, so I'm going to go ahead and introduce our keynote speaker for today's luncheon. It's my privilege to introduce Ana Gomez of NTIA. Natoa's had a very good working relationship with NTIA over the last couple of years, especially with the BTOP program beginning, and with Anna's presence here today, that relationship is going to continue, I'm sure. Anna joined the NTIA back in February of 2009. In her role there, she handles a wide range of communications and internet policy issues with a particular focus on spectrum management, public safety communications, and the agency's efforts to expand broadband access and adoption for all Americans. She was previously Vice President for Government Affairs at Sprint Nextel, and prior to that, she served for 12 years in various management positions at the FCC, including Deputy Chief of the International Bureau and Chief of the Network Services Division in the Common Carrier Bureau, which is now the Wireline Bureau. She also served as the Senior Legal Advisor to former FCC Chairman William Kennard, and she was also Deputy Chief of Staff in the National Economic Council during the Clinton administration. So I'd ask you to all join me with welcoming Ana Gomez as our next speaker.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to join Natoa at your annual conference to discuss the importance of broadband in today's digital economy and the critical role that we all play in bringing high-speed internet services to all Americans. Local government officials play a vital part in these efforts. Now, I took a look at the agenda over the past couple of days, and I know I'm going to touch on several areas that you've already been discussing, so I hope that I can add to that discussion or at least validate some of what's been said. Expanding broadband access and adoption is central to President Obama's strategy to build the innovation economy of the future, one that supports new and better jobs, enhances U.S. global competitiveness, and ensures that all Americans share in those benefits. If you don't have broadband today, you are increasingly cut off from the opportunities that high-speed internet makes possible. Now, while it's been roughly 15 years since the phrase digital divide gained national attention, it remains a serious issue in the United States. My agency, NTIA, is leading the way in researching the status of broadband access and adoption in the United States. So I'd like to give you a brief overview of our latest work and of our efforts to eliminate the technology divide, which will help more people succeed in this 21st century economy. First, let's take a look at broadband availability. In February of this year, NTIA, in collaboration with the FCC, released the National Broadband Map at broadbandmap.gov. It is the first public, searchable, nationwide map of broadband availability in the United States, and it shows what high-speed internet services are available to every single address in the country. Underlying the map is a massive database that includes more than 20 million searchable records, by far the most granular and most extensive data set of its kind. And the map serves many types of people. Consumers and small businesses can use the map to pull up a list of local broadband providers, along with details about the type of internet service they offer and the maximum advertised speeds they promise. Local officials can use the map to see how broadband networks in their communities compare to those in other communities. And this can help economic developers attract business or to address barriers to investment in their communities. And policymakers and researchers can use the map to compare broadband availability and speeds across geographies as well as across demographic groups, which can help inform policies to support private sector investments in broadband deployment and to target government efforts to bring high-speed networks to places that may be uneconomical for the private sector to serve. Yesterday, we rolled out the first significant update of that map since we launched in February. The map now offers a useful new research tool that can produce snapshots of individual broadband providers that show exactly where they offer service, what maximum speeds they advertise, and how much of the country or of a particular state, city, or county they cover. The map is an ambitious, unprecedented undertaking, and it is only possible because of this unique federal, state, and private partnership. NTIA created and is updating the map twice yearly in collaboration with the FCC, using data collected by every state and territory from the broadband providers themselves as well as from other resources. And we continue to work with our partners to strengthen the map. But you can help us too. If you have information that can help improve the map, we urge you to reach out to the entity that's gathering the data from your particular state. And you can find that on our website. And if you're using the map for local decision making or for any other policy purposes, we would love to hear about it. So what do the data that we have gathered so far tell us? Lots of things, including the fact that many community anchor institutions like schools and libraries appear to have broadband needs that are not being met. According to data from the map, 2/3 of schools have internet connections that are slower than 25 megabits per second, which is well below the 50 to 100 megabit per second connections that state education technology directors have told us are needed to serve roughly 1,000 students. And only 8% of libraries have connection speeds that are faster than 25 megabits per second. Another point that I want to emphasize is that although an overwhelming majority of Americans have access to broadband, we know from our research on broadband usage that only 68% of households have adopted broadband. And that leaves approximately 1/3 of Americans cut off from the digital economy at home. This finding comes from NTIA's annual broadband adoption survey of approximately 54,000 households, which the U.S. Census Bureau conducts for us, and then we release with a staff analysis, along with public release of the extensive data set so that other researchers can mine it as well. In February, we released a preview of the data collected in the October 2010 census survey. And one of our key takeaways is that while the digital divide has narrowed slightly, it still breaks down along historic demographic and geographic lines. So, for example, the adoption rates among whites and Asians exceed those for Black and Hispanics by 18 percentage points or more. And rural America lags behind urban areas by about 10 percentage points. And despite the growing importance of the internet in our daily lives, approximately 28% of Americans do not go online at all. And why is that? Our research finds that those who do not use the internet at all, whether inside or outside of their home, most often cite lack of interest or perceived need. While in contrast, those who don't have it at home but use it elsewhere, like at school or in a library, cite cost as the primary reason that they don't subscribe, as do those who use dial-up internet access at home. So the lesson learned is that we need a combination of approaches to bridge the digital divide, including targeted outreach programs to minority and to rural populations that emphasize the benefits of broadband. And that's exactly what some of our Recovery Act broadband projects are doing. Thanks to the Recovery Act, we are investing approximately $4 billion in about 230 strong, sustainable projects that will not only expand broadband access and adoption, but also will support economic growth, drive innovation, and create jobs. We're funding three types of projects: network infrastructure, public computing centers, as well as sustainable broadband adoption projects. And these investments reach every state and territory, and local government officials are an integral part of our efforts. You are in a unique position to understand the needs of your individual communities. And you have been on the front lines in applying for and in making the most of the federal dollars being devoted to broadband. In Maryland, for example, a public-private consortium is building a 1,300-mile fiber network that will bring broadband to all 24 counties across the state. The One Maryland Broadband Network, funded by a $115 million grant, will connect and extend three independent networks. And when it's done, the new network will deliver broadband speeds of up to 10 gigabits per second. and it will connect 1,000 community anchor institutions, including as many as 450 schools and 40 libraries, as well as provide direct fiber connections to 260 public safety facilities, allowing them to upgrade to next generation 911 service. And I'm pleased that one of the key drivers of this project, the Intercounty Broadband Network, is with us here at the conference to accept NATOA's Community Broadband Fiber Network of the Year award. In LA, city officials are expanding and upgrading 188 computer centers in libraries, in workforce centers, in community centers, and in other public facilities in low-income and non-English-speaking communities. The $17.5 million grant is paying for more than 2,700 new computers, which will be used for job training, as well as for computer training, among other things. At a Chicana Service Action Center facility in South Los Angeles, for instance, community members are using 25 computers to learn basic computer literacy, as well as how to write resumes and to get career counseling. Now, in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, a local school district is using a $3.2 million federal award to put 3,500 computers in the hands of economically disadvantaged middle and high school students in three counties. The program is providing vouchers for discounted broadband access to qualifying families that participate in workforce and computer training. And in Florida, the Tampa Housing Authority is using $2.1 million in federal money to provide subsidized broadband service, computer technician training, and basic internet skills classes in 23 public housing complexes. We hope these Recovery Act projects will help prime the pump for more private sector investment, as other broadband providers use the facilities funded with public money to expand and to upgrade their own networks. Already, providers have entered into more than 150 interconnection agreements with our grantees. And we're also exploring ways to extend the benefits of the projects that have received Recovery Act funding to benefit even more Americans. One example of this is our recently launched digitalliteracy.gov website. This site provides a central location where our grantees, many of whom are managing public computer centers and teaching computer-related skills, to upload digital literacy training materials, to share lessons they've learned, and to expand the reach of their projects. We expect these tools to be particularly useful for schools, for workforce training centers, and for libraries, and so we are partnering with the American Library Association and with the Institute of Museum Library Services to promote the use of the portal by public libraries. But anyone can use the site to get free training in a variety of digital literacy topics, including, for example, how to search and apply for a job online or how to protect your child online. Finally, I just want to say a few words about President Obama's American Jobs Act and the parts of the plan intended to ensure that we share the economic benefits of broadband. The administration sees wireless access as a key component of the push for universal broadband. The wireless industry represents an important bright spot in economic growth, driven by the wild popularity of smartphones, of tablet computers, and all these devices that we can't live without anymore. But we need more spectrum to be able to keep up with the explosion and of the bandwidth-hungry services that these new technologies give us. So the American Jobs Act would give the FCC the authority to conduct incentive auctions to free up more spectrum for wireless broadband use. And it's also a part of President Obama's wireless initiative in which we have been directed to find more spectrum to be able to allocate either on a dedicated or shared use for more wireless services, broadband services. And the American Jobs Act also delivers an important promise to public safety. It sets aside both spectrum and money for the construction of a national wireless broadband network that would help police officers, firefighters, and emergency medical workers to communicate with each other. The shortcomings of the existing networks became painfully apparent after the 9/11 attacks and after Hurricane Katrina, when emergency workers could not talk to one another because they were using incompatible systems. And the American Jobs Act would help ensure that this never happens again. This is just a couple of components of the American Jobs Act that will benefit our local communities. And in closing, NTIA is going to continue to be hard at work in finding ways to close the digital divide. We'll continue to update the national broadband map and hope that you will help us in doing so. And we'll continue to vigorously oversee our broadband grant programs to make sure that our grantees deliver the benefits that they have promised. And again, I just want to say thank you for inviting me to be here. I know we share the goal of bringing benefits of broadband to all Americans, and I wish you a very successful rest of your conference and a good lunch. Thank you.
We have a few minutes before our next session begins, so Anna has graciously agreed to take a few questions from you all. There's going to be a mic over on the far side of the room here that you can use, and I will be running around here like Phil, if you remember Phil Donahue. So raise your hands, I'll come get you.
I'm not hiding, I lost my pen.
Okay. Ah, that works. Hello. I have a quick question. Computing centers, broadband adoption programs, these are not revenue-generating activities. Have the recipients been required, or does NTIA have a program or plan in place for how these projects sustain themselves after the money runs out?
Well, the Sustainable Broadband Adoption Projects actually had a requirement that they demonstrate that they could, in fact, be sustainable. And it's not that we have a program to ensure sustainability. The Recovery Act dollars don't go further than they already exist. But they did have to show commitments from a variety of sources that would be able to maintain the sustainability of the projects.
Hi. As the broadband mapping matures, is there a chance we will ever see a guaranteed minimum speed as well as a guaranteed maximum speed?
Well, I think it's more than just the map maturing. I think it's technology maturing a little bit. The issue really is that it differs in so many ways that it's difficult to say, which is why we go with maximum advertised speeds for folks to know. But, you know, if we get to the point where technology can show us guaranteed minimum speeds and it's got all sorts of factors, loading factors, et cetera, I imagine someday.
Well, the guaranteed maximum speed, they can say anything.
And advertised maximum, not guaranteed, right?
Well, all right, advertised. I mean, all they're really saying is that we guarantee it'll never go faster than this.
Right.
And that's not very useful to a consumer. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Hi, Missy Herrera with Montgomery County, and we're part of the One
Hi,
Maryland.
Missy, yes.
Hey, we have to come to California to see each other.
So
we want to thank you for the grant, but just as a note for you, we do see that sustainability and availability are interlinked, in that if we can get more people mm-hmm. who have access, who can afford it to use it, that will put more money in and probably provide for those programs. But even in the way that you structured your BTOP to make those things separate divisions, there's $115 million coming to Maryland, mm-hmm. and not a dollar of that is dedicated to a computer in one of those 400 schools, libraries, and so forth. So one thing to look at is particularly fast-tracking. If there is ability for us to save money in the budgets that we have, being able to spend that on the end-user hardware mm-hmm. that you really need would be very useful. And I have to point out that I'll be remiss if not noting that all of the matching, a significant chunk of the matching funds that we use from that are generated through the franchise fees that your former colleagues at the FCC have an NOI open to looking at restricting our ability to do that. So what we need from you as well is partnerships to understand that these programs cost money at the local level, and we need that. So I guess the question is, are you working and taking the data that you've got and talking to the FCC about how communities are supporting the programs that NTIA is working on and the need to ensure that there is a revenue source to fund them?
Well, I will say, obviously we talked to our colleagues at the FCC quite a bit, particularly as new issues arise within the projects. I don't know whether we have raised this specific issue with the FCC, but I'll go back and check.
And Anna, we have one last question for you today.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Sherry McCullough, and some of my clients also benefited from the BTOP grants, and we thank you for those, to build middle mile in rural areas. My question is about broadband mapping. As these state entities report to you, we've noticed a number of places that are being overrepresented in terms of broadband coverage. And specifically, our concern is how to correct the record, especially since the FCC intends to rely on those maps for future support mechanisms. And in several instances, people have contacted the state broadband entity and tried to make the changes. They've even drawn boundaries and provided maps, but none of their emails or their calls are being responded to. So we recognize that it's not going to be 100% ever and that it's very fluid, but we would like for NTIA and FCC to consider, as they grant more support going forward, that if they're not represented as being underserved on the maps, that they will accept another survey so that the record can be corrected.
Yeah. You're raising a very important issue, and this is something that we hear about a lot, and that is how accurate is the data in the map. And we really do want to hear where there are inaccuracies in the map. And if you're not getting it through your local entities, then contact us, because we want the map to be as accurate as possible.
We do, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I would just like to ask all of us to thank Anna Gomez again for coming out here. Anna actually just flew out for this. She is leaving later on this afternoon to go to Boulder. So she had a long trip, but we appreciate it. So please continue eating. We will get ready and have the next panel up shortly. Thank you.
We're going to have a very interesting conversation this afternoon over the rest of our lunch period about broadband and technology and our economy and innovation. And I know this is a subject. Can you all hear me okay? Okay. This is a subject of enormous importance to local governments, and in fact is probably the one that, in my experience, is talked about most at the local level. And I think it's also the one where all of us as people who speak with elected officials and advise them need the best possible information and data and ideas about the connection between new technologies, particularly broadband, and our economies and innovation at the local level and on the national level. So that's what our conversation today is about, and I am extraordinarily privileged to introduce to you this panel. I will very quickly run through their backgrounds because I think you have more detailed bios in all your packets. But starting to my far left, Dr. Norm Jackness is the director of Cisco's Open Innovation and Strategic Advisory Group, IBSG Public Sector, it's called, and is a globally recognized expert in government innovation and transformation. Norm spent many years before joining Cisco as CIO and Commissioner of Westchester County, New York government, so he certainly understands the local government issues and imperatives. And continues to serve as technology advisor to the County Executives of America, and is very deeply involved in working with the National Association of Counties and the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and will share with us some of that work. To Norm's right, we have Blair Levin, who is an old friend to NTOA, and I know many of you recognize him. Where do I start to run through this? No chance. Mm-hmm. Blair is a Communications and Society Fellow with the Aspen Institute, where he's doing a lot of the most creative and progressive thinking about broadband and innovation, and he's going to share some of those ideas with us. Before that, Blair was Executive Director of the Omnibus Broadband Initiative at the FCC, which is another way of saying that he was the architect of the National Broadband Plan. Prior to that was at Legg Mason, Stifel Nicholas, practiced law, and before that, of course, was Chief of Staff under Chairman Reed Hunt at the FCC. And to my left, Katie Esbebeth, Vice President of EPB Fiber Optics, the City of Chattanooga's Municipal Fiber to the Home Network. Casey's been with EPB since November 2004, and she has 30 years of marketing and telecommunications experience. Before that, she had management positions for AT&T and Bell South. As Vice President of the EPB Fiber Optics Division, Katie's responsible for the continued development and sales of the 100% Fiber Optic Communications Initiative, including long-term business planning and development of new services, like EPB's 1 gigabit internet service, and we're going to hear about that initiative as well. So, is there feedback? Am I hearing some kind of noise? I'm going to just hold this. Is it any better? No? Yeah? Okay. So let me start by asking each of you, I want to have a discussion, but let me ask you each to take a few minutes and tell us about the initiative in which you are engaged and why you think it's connected to economic development and innovation. Norm, will you start?
Oh, okay, thank you. Thanks, everybody, for your attention. I'm with Cisco's, I guess, think tank is the best way to describe it. We're supposed to take a more strategic, longer-term view on things. We don't get involved with sales, so I can't talk about that part of the company. But about 2 years ago, I guess the U.S. Conference of Mayors came to us and said that we understand you folks are causing us a lot of problems. This world is changing, and we're not quite certain how we can deal with it, and so what we'd like you to do is help us develop a strategy to ensure the economic viability of American cities in 2030. Actually, that was a nice challenge. If they asked me to help them figure out how to survive the recession for the next 2 years, it would have been much tougher to come up with an answer. But you, as you well know, if a lot of you have been in this business, and I've been involved with the Internet, that's close to 20 years now, over the long run, things happen sooner or later, and it's sort of pretty clear in some respects some of the things that will happen. More recently, in fact, this same work has gone up to the state level. So there's a lot of interest in economic development and economic growth, as you said, and people have this uneasy feeling that what they used to do isn't working any longer, and there's some good reasons. Broadband is obviously a part of this. And I think most of us in this room at one point or another have made the assertion that broadband leads to economic growth. In fact, there have been some studies about that, a couple. The problem with a lot of those assertions is that they're actually fairly hard to prove, and one of the reasons has nothing to do with any of us. I think it took something like 30 years for economists to finally get sufficient data and analysis done to prove that the interstate highway system made sense. We're in the early days of the Internet. We do not have the kind of ubiquitous communications that will happen in the future. We certainly don't have video. I joke with my kids that my grandchildren will look at them as being rather quaint for texting. You know, because human communication is much more than the words. It's the body language and everything else that goes along. We don't have that yet. When we do that, we really dramatically change things. So merely making the assertion isn't very helpful, but beyond that, understanding why there might be a relationship between broadband and innovation and economic development is important, because it will give us an idea as to how this all will play out and what government ought to be doing about it. And so that's really been the thrust of what I've been involved with, and basically some of the implications. I'm not going to go into all this, we'll have a chance to talk about this, but some of the implications of this is that communications is essential for economic growth. It always has been, going back at least to Adam Smith. Innovation is obviously a key to economic growth, that always has been, and communications allows for innovation to occur. Innovation is not some genius sitting in a corner, but it's a social act. And to the extent that broadband enables that social act to bring together a more diverse, wider group of people, there'll be more innovation. So among the implications of this for government policy is that the old strategies that we used to have, which sort of fall into the category of job hunting, really have to shift to something that builds on broadband and builds applications on broadband in a way that's more like what some economic development folks call economic gardening. Is building up the resources and the attractiveness and all the rest of that within your community. And broadband is a part of that, it's a foundation, and it's in every single aspect of that. And I'll just leave it at that and let other people talk.
Thanks. Blair, you want to talk about innovation on broadband?
If you think about it, economic development is a function of accelerating the future. If you want to have economic development, you simply want to have in 2012 what otherwise would happen in 2020. And if you can do that, as every economic chart would show you, you will actually create a tremendous amount of economic growth. So in the National Broadband Plan, we really were focused on the question of how do we have the changes in the economy that drive economic development and new job creation. It's really all about high-performance knowledge exchange. The broadband platform is not important because of the speed or the technology. It is important because it allows human beings to exchange knowledge in more more high-performance ways. Interestingly, the sectors of the economy that would benefit the most from that actually have used it the least, which is education and healthcare. It's a whole other story. But in terms of economic development, and one reason why the plan focused on how to make those changes was because there's so much upside there. To get high-performance knowledge exchange, you need a broadband ecosystem that is ubiquitous, diverse, and constantly improving. I'm going to put aside for a second the ubiquitous and diversity and say that the constantly improving means that you need something that's on the cutting edge. And one of the problems that we identify is in the current American ecosystem, we benefit enormously from the competition of two wires to every home. But one of the downsides of that relative to the rest of the world is it's much more difficult for a variety of reasons to have next-generation networks built in this country, which is why you see them in Korea, you see them in Japan, you see them in Stockholm, you see them in other places. Actually, you see them in Chattanooga, but you don't see them in many other places in the United States. So we made some recommendations in the plan about how to address that. I have to say, they weren't that good. I'm sorry. We tried, but we kept thinking about the problem. After I left the broadband planning effort, the Google Fiber Initiative, which actually grew out of some discussions we had with them, got 1,100 communities to demonstrate not consumer demand for gigabit, but rather community interest in being on the cutting edge by having cutting edge networks. And so some of us said to ourselves, that's really extraordinary. And there's a huge amount of work, and we need to take advantage of that work, and we need to figure out some way in which it's not just one company doing it, it's multiple companies, it's not just one community, it's multiple communities. A critical mass, 24 dozen, 36 dozen. So then we said, which communities does it make the most sense to do it in economically? High density, high pre-existing assets, high demand. Turns out there's a category, a group of communities that fit that definition. Second question, very important. Which communities have the most innovation culture for the broadband platform? Communities in which getting them abundant bandwidth is not simply a matter of consumption, but also a matter of creativity. Turns out there's a group of communities that fit that as well. Turns out they're the same, university towns. So what we did was we went to the university towns that had applied for Google Fiber, and we said, let's flip the equation. And instead of having one supplier ask on the demand side for a good deal of competition, let's just flip it and have the best targets for innovation cause competition between cable, telco, Google, and anybody else to try to solve the problem of how do we get a critical mass of communities for next generation networks. And this is a project called Gig.U. We're doing it out of the Aspen Institute. We released a request for information last week. We have 37 university communities, largely flagship public institutions. We didn't go to the Ivies or Stanford for a variety of reasons, but we're in over 25 states. And we're having a big meeting in Chicago with all the communities, all the large telcos, all the large cable, and a bunch of other folks. The economic development component can be thought of this way. In the 1800s, to be in the manufacturing business, not every community could be in the manufacturing business. You needed to have abundant flowing water. That was the critical input for that part of the economy. In the 1900s, you needed abundant electricity, and often you needed land, and you needed to be near transportation hubs. So that part of the economy, not the entire economy, but that part of the economy went to those places. And what Gig.U about in terms of economic development is that in a very significant portion of the economy, you need two very critical assets in order to compete in that part. And that is very abundant bandwidth and very abundant human intellectual capital. And university towns are the primary place you can get both most quickly, and thereby accelerating that economic development. The model that we're going to end up with, and hopefully actually we'll end up with bunches of different models, will apply for some communities, but they won't really apply for everywhere. And I think this notion that we have to get everybody gets the same thing anywhere is actually non-economic and non-strategic. And reasonable minds can differ about that. But I deeply believe that if we're going to drive economic activity, if we're going to have the American broadband ecosystem be in 20 years what it actually is today, which is the best in the world, but it's under a significant challenge, we need to make sure that we have our engineers and our applications folks within the next several years designing, operating, implementing, and most important, working on the best networks in the world in a critical number of communities, so that's what I'm working on.
Katie, please.
Well, you're probably wondering why someone from an electric utility would be up here talking about broadband. But if you take a look at EPB, we're the Electric Power Board of Chattanooga, if you look at our core mission, you'll see that we really were created in 1935 to improve the quality of life for the folks in the valley, as well as to provide an environment that's conducive to economic development. When we started looking at building fiber into our electric system, it was over 10 years ago, but we did it for several primary reasons. First and foremost, we were looking for a way to modernize our electric system and provide more reliable electricity to our folks. And if you know anything about economic development, I'm sure you'll agree that a reliable, inexpensive electricity is vital to securing new industries and even growing businesses in your area. And then secondly, we just thought, well, you know, there's enough people who buy these services that can run these communication services that run over this type of fiber network that will be able to pay for this build by doing this. And then thirdly and most importantly, it was core to our mission. We cover about a 600 square mile area in southeastern Tennessee. We serve the city of Chattanooga, Hamilton County, and pieces and parts of nine other counties, including a couple in North Georgia. We built it primarily for smart grid, for more reliable electricity, but we've also been able to offer very advanced communication services. You probably heard of us about a year ago. We announced ubiquitous availability of gig services. And you know what? We didn't have a clue what could be done with gigabit speed internet bandwidth. Our community was very excited. There's a lot of pride in our community about having the fastest internet in the country. But we're figuring it out, and a lot of smart people around the world are helping us figure it out today as well. So I guess in summary, we'll talk more about this, I'm sure, as a panel, but the reason we did this was to create more jobs, better paying jobs, improve educational opportunities in our, for our citizens, give them access to better health care. And we have some very real examples of how what we think we've accomplished in the couple of years that it's taken us to build this network. We've built about 6,000 miles of fiber. We've hooked up about 36,000 customers in a two-year period, and we're growing by leaps and bounds. And we'd invite you to come to Chattanooga and take a look, and we especially would invite anybody to come and take a look at what our Chamber of Commerce has been able to do over the over this two-year period.
Let me pick up on the comment that Katie just made about Chattanooga went to a gig and didn't know what anybody was going to do with a gig, although we may find out in time. Can you each address the question of innovation and a gig? Do we need a gig to innovate? Are we somehow constrained in innovation by our current environment of DSL and cable, and then obviously fast-moving increases in wireless speed, but still the nature of wireless is that it's never going to be able to match what wireline networks can do. What's the relationship between a gig and big speed and innovation?
Well, I'll jump in terms of an example from Chattanooga, because the mayor was surprised by this. He said he didn't think anybody would actually want to buy a gig, and was quite surprised that people did, and including, for example, radiologists. Healthcare is a big business in Chattanooga. Teleradiology is not new. We've seen examples of this, but it turns out the radiologists have always been cautious about it because they've had to use compression in the past, and they're worried about some bit missing that's going to make them misdiagnose something, and their liability is rather large for that. With the gig, they can get this whole thing uncompressed, and so they actually have a much wider range of options they can do. And there's a National Cancer Tumor Registry, I guess, as well, which can use a gig, because you need this 3D visualization that you cannot put down a DSL line. So this is just two examples just today from Chattanooga.
And I'd add to that also that the same radiology practice has taken the time that it takes to read test results from 24 hours down to 15 minutes. And even though we're centrally located in Chattanooga, we have a lot of rural territory with a lot of rural hospitals in our service area. And so what Dr. Bush and his colleagues have been able to do is to provide faster and more accurate, actually, diagnosis to their patients. And they also say that they've gained the services of two virtual doctors by being able to move to this technology. And this is extremely important, especially in these rural areas.
Can I just, so in the 1600s, France and England had the same GDP. About 150 years later, England was considerably ahead. Why was that? Well, according to a book, the most powerful idea in the world, it had to do with the fact that innovation in France was directed by a Royal Academy, which gave out money to scientists who had inns with the academy, whereas in England they used a patent system that developed in the late 1500s that essentially gave a wild, chaotic opportunity to anybody to do things and gave them the fruits of that innovation after they'd actually done it. I was thinking about that as I was reading Tom Friedman's new book, This Used to Be Us, or That Used to Be Us, because he states a law that somebody says to him, which is, innovation from above is orderly and not that productive. Innovation from below is chaotic and very productive. And one of the things we saw in the broadband plan was, you know, we had tremendous innovation in the form of Bell Labs, but we don't have that anymore. We had Xerox PARC. We don't have that anymore. But we still have unbelievable innovation because of our research institutions, and they are the best in the world, to actually paraphrase Friedman. As to the research institution, this is still us. We are still us. We are still Americans. We still lead. And so the question is, how do you expand that platform in a way in which you answer the question of what do people do with it, not by having, you know, somebody like me say, here's what you do with it, but rather giving the tools and taking bandwidth as a barrier to innovation away from the equation. It's a little bit of a leap of faith, but it's a leap of faith which actually is completely consistent with the American economy and the American character. And I got to believe that if we do that, we will find out not just in healthcare, not just in education, which are the two most obvious ones, but a whole panoply of activity that none of us can imagine now, just as none of us, when I was at the FCC, when Mosaic came out, could have imagined a YouTube, a Facebook, et cetera.
And this is, you know, we're talking about a gig as if this is the Holy Grail. As somebody who once upon a time used a 300 baud acoustic coupler, I can tell you that a gig is not enough. We don't have it except in Chattanooga, but it's not enough. You heard Brewster Kahle say yesterday that his connection is 10 gig just for his project. We've been talking with Chattanooga about doing some really sexy demonstrations, more in the arts, with holographs. That can use up a gig connection real fast. This is never ending, and I think it just shows that this communications capability contributes to innovation, and then it feeds its own demand in a sense.
Sometimes when we talk about wanting big bandwidth and fiber in particular, people use the very derisive phrase, and they certainly mean it in a derisive way. They say, oh, build it and they will come, will never work. Are you all saying build it and they will innovate?
What I'm saying is our strategy should not be the strategy of Korea. Our strategy should not be the strategy of Europe because we have a different market structure. But I'm certainly, I am saying that if you build it strategically, you probabilistically increase your chances for both developing those applications and technological leadership. And if you don't build it, you massively increase the chances that 10 or 15 years from now, the next Google, the next Facebook, the next Amazon will not be here.
I think the answer to your question is, the reality is, even in the movie, they didn't all come. And not everybody's going to be a great innovator. The question is whether or not this facilitates connections among people who are innovative so they can actually be innovative. It's one thing to have an innate sort of native creativity, but if you're not in the stream of new ideas, then you're not going to be able to sort of really come up with new ideas to contribute to that. And so, in a sense, yes, I think this is absolutely, it's a necessary, maybe not a sufficient condition for creativity.
And I think we took the position of we don't really know what can develop because of access to this type of bandwidth. There's certainly studies that show that it provides an environment for all sorts of new innovation. But we saw our role as providing the infrastructure for people to be able to come and to use and to grow.
So to that point of providing the infrastructure, I think Katie has to some degree already answered this question, but please feel free to chime in. What are the tools? What are the things that we need to do? What are the means to get there?
Well, let me mention one. The primary tool, we had the BTOP program and the BIP program, so that was about $7 billion. Every year, the FCC spends more than that on universal service. And it's notable in Anna's speech, she mentioned that, recall that universal service prior to the 96 Act was about two things, which is last mile deployment to homes in high cost areas, and secondly, help for low income individuals. And there was a certain ratio, which was about 4 to 1 of dollars spent on that. We added then institutional support, primarily for schools, but also libraries and healthcare facilities, and other and anchor institution support. I gave a speech the other day in which I said, I'm deeply concerned about the current effort to reform universal service, because if you think about how broadband changes things, we ought to probably be spending more on adoption. We also, by the way, as Anna's data shows, we probably need to spend more on classrooms, because that's where the real uptick is. And we need to look at that and examine that in terms of how we do it relative to rural homes. It's just, you know, if there's a limited number of dollars, you gotta prioritize things. So I said I was deeply concerned about this because the way the proposal the FCC is looking at, I think, locks in the existing ratio, even though it ought to change, and in fact may significantly increase the amount we spend on rural homes. And I'm not opposed to rural homes. I'm just saying that as a matter of priorities, I'm not sure that we're not having a good debate about that. I might note that someone from purporting, I guess, who represented the chairman's office, though I doubt he actually represented the chairman, said that I was putting the cart before the horse. And what I would say to you is, that's a really weird metaphor. What I'm actually saying is, I'm deeply concerned we're going to spend all our money on the cart, that is to say, deployment to the last mile homes, leaving us no money to spend on the horse, which is adoption, or institutional support, meaning that we're going to end up with a cart that can't go anywhere. And I really deeply believe that you all are affected by this, and this, the way they're doing universal service reform, there's a lot of good in the package that they're considering, but I'm deeply concerned that what's gonna happen is we're gonna find out after they adopt it that all the money is spent in a way, or all the money is committed in a way that over time puts enormous pressure on the E-rate, puts enormous pressure on essentially the low-income adoption, and just has us spending in money in a way that really isn't the primary priority at this point in time.
There are some things that people can do that are beyond national policy. We should step back for a second. Although I'm from a company that makes communications products, I will make the argument that it's not the communications alone that makes a difference here. And in fact, arguably in the 1800s, the telegraph had a much more dramatic increase in speed than anything we've seen from the internet. The difference was we were in an industrial age in which most Americans were making things and food. Today we're in an age in which we're in a knowledge economy, an economy in which a majority of people are involved in actually very much intangible services and products, and which often are digital. And so our digital communications capability that's increasing has a lot more dramatic impact on today's society for that reason. And if you think about what the major institution might be of this century, it might be the library. And so that's one of the things that is sort of to some extent under your control at the local level. The library can play a key role in helping make a success of some of this. And I don't mean through community computers and all that sort of stuff. Yes, that's the role. But for economic development, which is one of the main themes I think about, you can imagine a virtual librarian being a virtual reference librarian for your entrepreneurs. There's a world of information out there. There's a wonderful Stanford down the road here in MIT and Princeton, and you're not going to have most of those in your backyard. But all the research that's coming out of those places is available to your entrepreneurs almost to the equal, not today, but certainly 10 years from now, almost to the equal of being in Palo Alto. And the library can be the institution that helps organize that for them, find it for them, so that they can then pursue whatever they can. And more generally, what you can do in a community is to provide the collaborative tools, or at least to help people learn how to collaborate so that your entrepreneurial community, so that your residents can seek out each other and present themselves as a stronger economic unit to the rest of the world.
You want to comment? I would just say we saw our role a little bit differently, and that was as a government entity, basically municipally owned, we really saw and continue to see our role as building infrastructure for our community. Several of you have heard me tell this story in the room before, but in 1969, Walter Cronkite opened the 6 o'clock evening news by naming Chattanooga the dirtiest city in the country. That really made us kind of raise ourselves up by our bootstraps and decide that that's not the kind of city we wanted to be. We were also seeing manufacturing jobs leaving. We were seeing companies close down, and we saw we didn't see a great future for Chattanooga. And that's really when a group of citizens came together and began a visioning process for what did they want to see Chattanooga become. And this was just a very small part of it. So again, we really saw this as infrastructure. We saw something that the city and the community actually had to have if Chattanooga was going to improve and really become a viable community.
Can I just add very quickly that I completely agree with the comment about the library? Is my mic on? Can you hear me in the back? Can't. I completely agree with the comment about the library. And in fact, in the National Broadband Plan, we kind of noticed that the federal government didn't have much money around. So there are almost no recommendations that actually ask for a specific amount of money. One of, I think, only three that did related to libraries, because in a kind of counterintuitive way, broadband makes them more valuable, in a, you know, as opposed to the books. Obviously, that recommendation did not get funding from Congress, which was too bad. And what I'm worried about is that the federal money that flows to libraries from the federal government program actually could be diminished as a result of the universal service reforms, which actually probably should increase it.
I just want to make a comment about Chattanooga. I'm an outsider, so I can say that she can't. You know, there's an intangible here. I work with people all over the country, and unfortunately, I'm not sure that there's much you can control about it, but Chattanooga has a functioning civic culture. Washington, D.C. could learn a lot from Chattanooga. You know, despite the normal partisan differences you might imagine, there is a sense in that community that's about their future and about innovation, the importance of innovation, that goes back way beyond even the 10 years of playing at EPB on the communications network. It has to do with sort of how they deal with urban design, how they're looking at the city in a variety of ways, not just the technology. It's hard to recreate. It's absolutely necessary, and that's, I think, going to be one of the things that will make places like Chattanooga success stories here in the U.S. and anywhere else.
Thank you.
These qualities and initiatives and efforts at the local level are, as Norm said, some of the things that the people in this room can impact. Blair, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this also. What would you like to see localities doing? And please feel free to make reference to GigU in this regard, but where would you like to see help and support, and where would you want to see localities working on infrastructure, innovation, broadband issues? We may disagree.
We might disagree. I'll mention a couple of things. First of all, let me start by saying that I want to congratulate you all for giving an award to Commissioner Clyburn. It's richly deserved. One of the recommendations on the plan was that Congress should preempt state laws that limit local efforts. And she was very much a part of that and was very active in the North Carolina thing, as you all know. And so certainly that's something we actually agree on. But I would say that one of the things that was interesting about the Google and Kansas City agreement is the extent to which the city started to understand that the benefits of certain assets that they have really are better monetized not through charging a fee, which is essentially a fee for a monopoly right, like access to rights of ways or others, but by having more economic activity flow over those rights of ways. Now, I'm not suggesting it because I know Nick Miller is already thinking, Blair, are you going to go and say that Congress should restrict it? That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that as an economic matter, one thing that I'd like to see is more cities essentially offer to do what Kansas City did. Most cities, I think, psychologically and or consciously or unconsciously believe, and frankly, I think they may well be right, it's highly unlikely you're going to get a new entrant, and therefore, at this moment in time, whatever we're charging the existing incumbents is okay, because we're not really going to detract from economic performance. I think we need to rethink that equation, and that as we try to expand different kinds of networks, that's going to be an important thing. I think if you look at other elements of that, whether it be giving priority for inspections or access to certain government buildings or certain demand aggregation functions, those are all kinds of things that can help, I think, stimulate greater investment. But it's not going to work everywhere. And so, part of what we're trying to do with the gig.u process is drive a bunch of different models so that people can see certain things that work and certain things that don't work. I think it's really important that there always be some kind of aspirational element out there that people keep pushing to it, because, you know, look, you may say a gig isn't enough. My attitude is more like, when we get there, we'll get there, right? But the notion that we have it only in Chattanooga or only in a couple of other places, that's not going to really work for us. So it's really, how do we get the ball rolling in a sufficient number of communities where you can start to see what the benefits are and take bandwidth away as an inhibitor of innovation?
Norm, I want to invite you to speak to the rights-of-way issue, too, as a former local government official. But I'd like you all to address also in the context of that, and where does municipal broadband fit into that? Because when we ask municipalities to make certain kinds of efforts to facilitate private deployment, where should public efforts on deployment fit? Where are they appropriate? Where are they advisable?
You want to answer the last question first, I guess.
In whatever order you like. And I guess I should also bring this back to innovation and the economy.
Right. The last question is the big one. So I'll address that. I mean, my attitude about it is that I think it's important for the larger economy and for our society that we really get up to speed, if you will, on broadband. Personally, and I think this is true for the company as well, you know, we don't care who does it, in a sense. We want to support the efforts. There's a larger question here, and I've actually given some thoughts to this. I don't have the answer, but I've given some thoughts to this. If you look at previous major infrastructure issues, the answers are not exactly clear. And I actually did a study of the New York City subway system, mass transit, right? It was originally started by private companies, very much the way that we've had most of our communication structure built in this country. Ultimately, because effectively mass transit in an urban environment is a public good and not sustainable as a profit-making business, the government ended up inheriting this. But they inherited a mess that wasn't interoperable. To this day, the original lines still dominate and cause inefficiencies. There's a question here as to whether or not, even if we argue today that the private sector should be the ones building some of this fundamental infrastructure, I'm not talking about to the home, but the backbones, whether or not the city's going to end up owning it anyway at some point in the future, who knows. We had this big railroad boom in this country, too, in the 19th century, and it was created a number of great barons, including the fellow who built this grid university not far from here. But eventually, of course, that all fell apart. So, I don't have the answer. And there are other examples you can think of that where things continued in the private sector. I'm very experimental about this. That's what I think. Franklin Roosevelt, when he was president, was great. Let's try experiments. Let's see what works and go for that.
That is what, relentless experimentation, I believe, yes. is the phrase. And that's what that we're trying to create a platform that does that.
I'd probably be remiss if I didn't go back and revisit the really driving reason for building the network was for our electric service. And by building the fiber infrastructure, we created what we think is a very sophisticated smart grid that includes thousands of points of communication throughout the service area, 1,500 smart switches. But what that means to the community in very real dollars is what we estimated to be about a 40% reduction in outage minutes. That's duration, not 40% reduction in outages, because trees are still going to fall. But it means we can get your power turned on faster for you. And for a community the size of Chattanooga, that means about $40 million a year in cost savings in lost productivity. That's substantial. Some other benefits to this type of infrastructure is theft reduction. People steal electricity, which I just find amazing. And in most utilities, EPB, prior to building this, didn't have a way of knowing if you were stealing electricity unless someone called and reported you or unless someone just spotted it. And to EPB, that was worth about $10 million a year. And that cost all of our ratepayers. With smart grid technology, we know immediately when someone has tampered with the meter. Automated meter reading. Trust me, we would not have done this if that had been the only benefit. That's worth about $2 million a year in savings to us. So when you put all these things together, there's a lot of justification for building this type of network if that were the only use that you got out of it at all. But because it is all 100% fiber, you are able to offer these type of communication services, which again goes back to opportunities for innovation and for economic development.
I want to ask one more question, but invite anybody who has questions themselves to please line up by that microphone. My last question relates to a comment Norm made earlier about the fact that we don't have a lot of studies or a lot of research that shows us exactly what the economic development and innovation implications are of broadband. Am I summarizing that right? I don't want to speak for you.
What I said was we don't have the kind of economic studies of the impact of broadband investments that we, for example, now have for the investment in interstate highway. I think, though, if you look at the fundamentals of development economics, it's pretty clear how broadband will help.
Is it just a question of time until we have the data we need? Because a lot of the decisions that would drive some of this, I think, sometimes is that we don't have that data and we don't have that those studies. And what's standing in the way of the research that needs to be done to establish what I think we all agreed on here, which is that this is pretty important for innovation?
Well, in terms of the empirical studies, the kind of basic statistical analysis, what's standing in the way is mostly time. Right? If we were 20 years from now, we'd have 20 years of data, right? And that's sort of a fundamental problem. The other is that there hasn't been enough time for this whole thing to really diffuse in society. You know, we live and breathe this stuff, but a lot of people have not yet been affected. They to some degree changed their lifestyles, but fundamentally economics are beginning to change, but it's not recognized. I mean, the fact, for example, that most large corporations now need half the square footage per employee that they did 10 years ago is something that's not widely known, that's been caused by the fact people are doing a lot of work at home and on the road. Because buildings take a while to build, that you haven't seen the impact of that yet. So there's a lot of this stuff just going to take time to show up.
Well, I'd say that we've got some very short-term examples of why we think this is a success already and will continue. We launched 2 years ago, and in this last two-year period, Chattanooga has landed a third of all the jobs that have come to Tennessee in that period. We have 2,400 new jobs that we can point to over the last 12 months that the companies have publicly stated. One of the primary reasons that they came to Chattanooga was, in fact, because of this fiber infrastructure. And then on a smaller scale, we have an event every April in Chattanooga where we invite entrepreneurs to come, and they basically lock themselves away for 48 hours. It's called the 48-hour launch. And this year, we supplied gigabit access to them so they would have access to financial institutions, to consultants, to different people. And at the end of 48 hours, 10 entrepreneurial companies were launched. And I think that's real evidence. It's not long term, certainly, and things will go up and down over a long period of time. But we feel like that's very concrete evidence that these kind of networks can improve the atmosphere for economic development.
In the mid-90s, Stanford historian Paul David wrote an essay called The Computer and the Dynamo, which asked the question, why is it that we don't see productivity statistics that we should see relating from the computer revolution? And there were two things that he pointed to. Number one, we're simply measuring the wrong thing, because in a transformational kind of change like this, you measure the past, you don't measure the new stuff. There's just simply, I mean, how would you measure the fact that we can all find things due to Google so much faster, right? Where does that show up in a statistic? But the second thing you pointed to, which actually I think is the more interesting one, is that it took more than 40 years for 50% of the factories in the country to get electricity. And that's a long time, even in the 1880s to 1910 or 15. And the reason was because when electricity came out in the late 70s and in 1880s, every architect who'd ever designed a factory had done it based on water power. And so they're in their head going, well, this is kind of nice, but what do I need it for? Everyone who'd ever invested in a factory already had invested in the factory. So there is a time period where you have this both embedded cost that's economic, but also embedded thinking, which really has to change. And so you get to a new generation, which in the case of factories, it was Henry Ford, saying instead of building the factories based on water power that was vertical, let's do it horizontally, because that's actually the only way to make a car. And it completely changed the way we thought about manufacturing. We haven't had that moment yet with big broadband, but that moment doesn't come until kind of a new generation arises that knows not dial-up.
And I want to elaborate a little on Blair's first point, because it's important to the people in this room. When you're talking about economic studies, and we don't measure a lot of the impacts of broadband and the Internet. A good example I can give you is when Encyclopedia Britannica was the main encyclopedia around, it's several hundred million dollars a year in sales, were part of the gross domestic product. They were measured by economists. Now nobody uses it anymore. We use Wikipedia. And arguably a lot more people are getting more value and more knowledge from Wikipedia than the fewer people who use Encyclopedia Britannica. But if you look at the economic statistics, the gross domestic product, they probably only count the couple hundred thousand people that Jimmy Wales has down in his offices in Florida, not the economic value that all of you get. And so we're not measuring a lot of the benefits. And that's something that is going to have to be addressed as well. And it will take time for people to catch up with that aspect of it, too.
Let's go to questions, and Nick's first.
Blair knew he could get me to the microphone. I actually just wanted to make a point and then ask a question. I think Blair's view and mine are, in fact, very comparable on right away. And I want to develop it in saying how strongly I am attracted by your idea of the creative chaos rising from the bottom rather than the National Academy making decisions from the top. If you take as a principle that right away is one of the most important investment resources, assets that are held by local government, isn't it most appropriate that the local government itself make the decision about the best way to commit that asset and the best way to use it? And I'd use for an example the historic reality with the mayor of Kansas City, who was here yesterday. In 1850, the economic dynamo in that part of the world was the city of Leavenworth, Kansas. The railroads went to the city fathers of Leavenworth, which was then the kicking off place for the Santa Fe Trail and the fort, and said, "We want to come to town." And the city fathers said, "We don't want you. You're dirty, you're ugly." And the result was Kansas City. And you look at the comparison today between Leavenworth and Kansas City, and there's no issue that local governments make good decisions and bad decisions, but it works best if you let them make their own decisions and not have the the FCC make decisions for us.
Yeah. Well, look, Nick and I have been discussing and debating this issue for 15, 20 years now, and I would hate to end our, every 6-month cup of coffee by actually either agreeing with him or disagreeing with him so emphatically. For the purposes of a lot of different FCC rules, I think it actually is a complicated question, though I tend to agree that decisions made on a local level was probably the right place to do it. But then there are some, the question is, what constraints are there that are important from a national perspective? So I actually don't want to answer that question, except to say that as to the gig.u initiative, what I'm really saying is it's a frame of mind that is not about how do we maximize revenue, but rather over a single asset, but how do we maximize economic activity. And so I think all of the towns that we're involved in, just as Kansas City did, and indeed as any of the 1,100 communities who applied to Google would have eventually done, is to try to figure out what can you do to decrease the cost of deployment. And to the extent it's rights of way, that's a choice, and I'm perfectly comfortable having the cities have complete discretion in how they address it for that purpose.
How are we doing for time? I'm sorry to have no watch. Don't know. 5 minutes. Okay, thanks. I'm going to invite anybody else who wants to come and ask a question. Otherwise, I do not lack for questions. Okay, here we go. I'm going to reserve 2 minutes at the end for my last question. Jerry.
Blair, asking you if, to the extent you can without, confidence, says, how do we in local government better advocate at the FCC? I mean, with you and a number of other folks, we've always at least got the ear and an honest response. But the ear and the honest response doesn't always translate up on the eighth floor when rules are written. How can we do it better?
Or
does that laugh mean it doesn't matter how well we do it?
No,
the disposition is already written.
No, the reason I'm laughing is that, look, you and I have chatted about a variety of issues over the years. Every issue is a little bit different. I used to advise people. I never was an advocate, but I used to advise people, and things are very different. I'll tell you a quick thing, which the other night, John Stewart interviewed Ron Suskind, the author of the new book, The Confidence Game, Confidence Man, I can't remember, but the And Stuart said to Susskind, I don't get it. You know, like all these Wall Street people keep saying that Obama is a socialist and he really hates us. But as far as I can tell, Tim Geithner in your book demonstrates this, completely carried, you know, the Wall Street agenda and very successfully got that agenda done. Why do Wall Street people keep saying that about Obama? And I'm just reporting here, by the way. I'm not saying this. I'm just reporting that Ron Susskind said this. So Susskind says, you know, I talked to someone on Wall Street about it, and I said, why do you guys keep saying that? And the guy said, well, you know, none of us actually believe it, but every time we criticize Obama that way, he does more for us.
I love it.
I'm just reporting. I'm not... So you could take that as a way of lobbying the FCC. But I think it's... Look, I actually am really disturbed by the following. I think the notion of the FCC as an expert agency is falling. And I mean this quite sincerely. I think if you look at things like the D block, like Light Squared, like, you know, certain things are very appropriate for political decisions, but you can't make a good political decision unless you have an expert agency that has some sense that it is looking at things as an expert and then providing to Congress a certain level of expertise in which Congress then makes its appropriate decisions about those things. And so, you know, I think the challenge for you all is you want to address the FCC like an expert agency. I know that you do that in your filings. And I think that it's unfortunate, and this is not a partisan thing, nor is it a personal thing. This is a longer-term historical trend in which the reputation of the FCC as an expert agency that then, when it says something, carries a certain kind of authority, that gets diminished. And that's unfortunate, but then that affects how you guys have to lobby.
Thanks.
I actually think we're at the end of our time, and although I was thinking about one more question. I'll just say, I think we're ending on a somewhat high...
Becoming president, ask it. Who's going to yell at you?
To end on a relative high note, I'm very proud to be associated with a conference in which John Stewart has been mentioned in multiple sessions. So thank you very much. Thank you to our speakers.
I hope that's the same story.
Thank you.